This is Ann Dalton reading for Sun Sounds for the program Are We There Yet? Today I have a fascinating story that takes place in Sri Lanka. It's called Following in the Footsteps of Elephants on a Journey Through Wild Eastern Sri Lanka. It's written by Lorna Parks on the National Geographic website. And here we go. Heading southeast from the tea plantations of Sri Lanka's highlands, vast tracts of jungle flow toward the beach through less visited national parks like Yagel Oya. Travelers can view the wilderness from a train, take a tuk-tuk safari, or hike in the footsteps of elephants with the indigenous Veda people. We move as a tight-knit herd. "It's like a sauna in here," whispers my guide, Kapi, mopping his brow and wafting air up his white polo shirt. A baby's foot digs into my ribs as we lurch forward, carried by a sea of people trying to get closer to a casket so luminously golden it looks like it's glowing. Tray after tray of perfumed white jasmine, gardenia, and lotus flowers are held aloft and pushed forward by human chains of devotees. All this for a tooth, but not just any tooth. The casket holds a rare relic of the Buddha, said to have been smuggled out of southern India in the locks of a princess's hair in the 4th century CE. It eventually found its way here to the highland kingdom of Kandy in central Sri Lanka. Kandy fell to the British in 1815 during colonial rule, but reverence for the temple of the sacred tooth that houses the casket continued to grow. 3 times a day, hundreds of pilgrims and curious travelers now come for this puja ceremony. When the doors to the shrine are opened, played out to booming drums, shrill clarinets. It's one of the world's holiest Buddhist sites and a baptism of fire for my trip into the east of Sri Lanka. For all the symbols of gilded devotion, it's the temple's volume of ivory, some fake, some real, that stays with me. Dozens of tusks protect the shrine complex like a rib cage around a precious beating heart. "The British came to Sri Lanka not just for spices, but for ivories," said our guide, Kapi, after the ceremony. At the time, the whole of Sri Lanka was covered in elephants. The British came to the highlands, hunted the elephants, and cleared the thick forest to plant tea. I see the tea bushes for myself the next day, taking my place by the open window aboard a train that climbs steadily above Kandy's heat haze with the deafening roar of a tiger. An hour or so out of town, sarong-clad pickers hoist hessian sacks, and farm workers stop to stare as we pass. After Sri Lankan independence in 1948, the tea plantations remained as a legacy of colonialism. Lipton's is just one of the major names still present in these hills. I'm on another remnant, the famed Kandy to Ella railway line, originally built by the British to transport tea from the highlands for export. It's now lauded as one of the most scenic train rides in the world and celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. We are swallowed up and spat out by the landscape, careering through wide ravines watered by cascades and squeezing into dark tunnels that burrow under palm-tipped mountains. Tiny settlements and brightly painted stations flash by like rapidly changing TV channels. A perfect wall of ebony black, ivory-tusked elephant statuettes appears out of nowhere beside the tracks guarding a temple. As passengers talk in hushed tones, hawkers navigate seating booths and doorways selling chili mango and peanuts fried with curry leaves. A child waves at us from a river as we pass above him on a metal bridge, then dives under the caramel-colored water like a fish. Taking it all in are Stanley Disenyaki and Karuna Talaka, protection force officers with wrinkled eyes and starched tamarind brown uniforms. They take empty window seats. Their gaze is routinely drawn to the scenery as much as mine. Stanley tells me that they've both been working for the railway since 1988, and he will soon retire. From my deepest heart, I love it, he says. No other country is like Sri Lanka. Everywhere you look is green, green, green. Rice country. Stanley's affection is infectious. Getting off the train at tiny Hepatali station, five stops before the busy hill town of Ella, it isn't long before I find myself sat by a swimming pool with sun loungers under a pagoda in Welawaya, admiring a startlingly green panorama. Some 35% of Sri Lanka's land is devoted to rice cultivation, and the view in front of me is an almost neon blanket of rice paddies. I'm staying at an agro-tourism hotel called Katarukitha, and as well as hosting 25 bungalows, its lands are working rice farming cooperative, with 50 acres given to local families growing highly profitable heirloom grain varieties. The estate provides equipment and training to work the land organically. The families care for it, and they split the harvesting profits 50-50. There used to be 31 farming families here, and now there are 70, says Salani Thenakoon proudly the next morning as she talks me through the community model. Employed as a naturalist by the hotel, she's dressed in full khaki uniform and has taken me to see the paddies while on a bird-watching walk. It's planting season, and in the coolness of dawn, farm hands in cloth hats and wellies have emerged to work the sodden fields. We spot a black-headed ibis, its giant beak like a wizard's wand, nosing for insects along leggy wading birds such as snow-white cattle egrets, pond herons, and red-wattled lapwings. Our route back into the forest weaves among black pepper creepers and fig and tamarind trees. A crested serpent eagle rustles branches above our heads, and there are tantalizing, far-off glimpses of giant squirrels, a rare electric blue oriental dwarf kingfisher, and Malabar pied hornbills shaking the tree canopy. I hear the thud of falling mangoes and papayas as we follow a broad woodland trail. During harvest season, wild elephants use this path, Salani tells me, explaining that they are drawn out of protected areas to look for food because the wilderness they live in is shrinking. As if on cue, I'm stopped in my tracks by a blast of firecrackers in the distance, a practice the Katarukitha estate has banned, but one still used by many farmers to ward off wildlife they consider pests, such as peacocks and elephants. In this area, we see the conflict between humans and elephants a lot, especially in the dry season when farmers harvest, she says. They destroy the farms. Elephants like the rice, but not just a small portion. They eat the whole area. It's not only the crops at risk, but the people too. Recent surveys suggest the number of wild elephants in Sri Lanka has now exceeded 7,000, but naturalists believe the government is downplaying the figures so as not to exacerbate increasing conflicts between humans and elephants. Every day, either an elephant or a human dies in Sri Lanka, says Salani. A crossing elephant traffic sign appears beside the unfenced roadside jungle later that day as I'm en route to Geloya National Park. An alternative to busy Yala, further south, the park's headline attraction is its swimming elephants, who routinely paddle between islands in Senanyake Samudra Lake, Sri Lanka's largest body of fresh water. By the afternoon, I'm surveying that lake from a small boat, one of only three allowed to operate trips here to keep tourist numbers down. With naturalist guide Anuruddha Harath from Geloya Lodge. He wears long dreadlocks tied in jute string and a solitary wooden earring. Like Salani, he's part of a generation passionate about their country's environment. Water levels are very high at the moment, about 100 feet. This doesn't happen often, says Anuruddha, explaining that we're actually looking at a dammed reservoir and the main source of water for eastern Sri Lanka. Water levels are dictated by farmers' irrigation needs. The weak breeze is no match for the ferocity of the sun as we putter slowly between shrinking islands and half-submerged trees like a Dali painting. We spot a troop of marooned gray langur monkey on one islet and skinny buffaloes on another. Trapped in their own shrinking biomes, the wildlife is waiting for the high waters to recede and free them. I can see so many ways to control conflict between locals and elephants, but we have to get it right, says Anuradha, scanning the shoreline of drowned boulders with his binoculars for signs of gray hides. He is worried about farming in the area increasing, thanks to a major sugarcane project signed off with one of Sri Lanka's big sugar factories. When the elephants' food dries up, they sometimes go to the villages and try to take their food. There are no signs of elephants until we alight for the masala chai and butter cake on a tiny hill of an island with old traces of straw-like dung at the top. Scaling the steep rock face, I can see the furthest boundaries of the lake, an irregularly shaped jawline of mountains where any manner of life could be hiding. Less than a century ago, this area, known as Danigala, was an ancestral home of Sri Lanka's indigenous Veda people. Archaeologists have traced the gene pool of these forest dwellers back to the prehistoric Belangoda man, the earliest inhabitants of Sri Lanka who lived up to 40,000 years ago. Their hunter-gatherer way of life remained remarkably intact in this area until the waters were dammed to create the reservoir in 1954 and the national park boundaries were drawn the same year. Slowly but surely, the Veda were forced out of the jungles. Yeloya Lodge has spent years developing tourism activities with these displaced people as a way of acknowledging their significance to Sri Lankan history. The next morning, in the lodge's thatched poolside lounge pavilion, I meet Nenigala Baha Bandalaji Jay, a Veda community elder who is to accompany me on a jungle trek before Anuradha and I set up our overnight camp on the edge of the national park. Gentle-eyed, bare-chested, and barefoot, he carries a hand-chiseled axe and bow and tells me he was born in a cave not far away. Now 68, Jay says he remembers being 6 or 7 when his parents relocated to build a mud brick house in the community of Rathagala on the park's edge. With the jungle being so untamed, our aim on this hike is to take advantage of natural paths cleared by the elephants. If we see elephants, the main thing is don't panic, instructs Anuradha from behind as I take my place in the line with Jay in front of me, heading southbound beneath a punishingly hot, clear sky. It dawns on me that now we're at ground level. We're not hoping to see elephants, quite the opposite. But as the forest closes in on us, I can smell them. The fresher the elephant dung on our path, the stronger the scent. I consider that they might even be watching us from behind the giant wall of banyans. Talking through a translator, I ask Jay if the elephants trouble him. He gives me a quizzical look, shrugging, as if they're as much a part of the land as the earth he walks on or the air he breathes. Through the eyes of Jay, I see the jungle's many treasures. We collect grape-sized turkey berries and curry leaves for our camp dinner and pause to pop tiny citrusy sweet jackal jujube fruit in our mouths. He picks apart the fibers of Arala creepers to show why they've been used since time immemorial to make the Veda's hunting bow strings strong, and shows me shy mimosa plants that curl up and hide as we brush past. It's a good antiseptic. You chew it and then put it in the wound, explains Jay. Though the Veda are still free to collect medicinal plants and honey in the jungles, Sri Lanka's 1983 Wildlife Conservation Act was the death knell for many of their hunter-gatherer traditions. Most villagers and Vedas still want wild meat on their table, says Anuradha, as we pause to check a leopard monitoring camera in a woodland clearing. There on the screen, I'm shown a poacher with a lifeless green langur monkey slung across his back. But the camera reveals a cast of thousands, endangered thick-tailed pangolins, barking deer, fishing cats, elephants, and the elusive leopard have all passed by here in the last fortnight. Whatever animal you expect to see in Sri Lanka, it's here in Galoya, says Anuradha. The area's leopard monitoring project was derailed by the pandemic, but resurrected last year with 10 cameras operated around the park. The lodge plays a key role with its naturalist guides logging data from the images at its on-site research center. Before COVID, 20 different leopards had been identified around the park. We think there are more than there were a couple decades ago, but we don't know for sure, said Anuradha, as we press on. Nobody has done research on this before. Not more than 10 minutes from our camp for the night, he motions for me to stop moving with a small hand wave, then puts his finger to his lips. Elephants, he whispers. I hear them before I see them. One, two, then three of them sluggishly emerge into a bright forest clearing, their trunks stripping branches for food. They are there 1 minute and gone the next, the dense vegetation providing a cloak of invisibility as they sense our presence and drift away. I never quite shake the feeling that we are walking in the footsteps of these gentle giants. There's another lone wanderer on a hill overlooking our camp for the night. Our base is a broad spit of land with a glassy lake on one side, with fishing boats tied up at the bank. On the other, there are sunken rice paddies dotted with shacks on wooden platforms where farmers have retreated from the baking heat. As dusk falls and fires are lit to create a perimeter around the camp, elephants start to trumpet nearby, yet the night passes peacefully with cooling breezes and a cocooning stillness proving a soothing sleep tonic. And our next story is on a different continent, entitled Feel the Call of the Wild on a Moose Safari in Maine's Great North Woods. This is by Mike McEachern, again from National Geographic. Maine's Great North Woods is one of the best spots in the country to catch sight of the world's largest deer species, making for a majestic wildlife safari. What do moose and teenagers have in common? It might sound like an odd question, but it's one wildlife guide Chris Young has a serious answer for. The males are like hot-headed schoolboys and have an aggressive grunt like, "Hey, ladies, I'm over here," he says, lifting his pocket binoculars to scan the hardwoods for movement. Ahead, a thin trail stops abruptly at a still lake, the last hour of daylight casting a fine, silvery glow on its surface. "The girls have a more social snort," he says. "We mimic their calls in different ways." Chris is guiding me on a four-hour safari around Maine's section of the Great North Woods, 40,000 square miles of wilderness that span four northeastern states, and it's thrilling to hear the moose call enthusiast ape their vocalizations. His call is a low, bassy, throaty gurgle. It's intense, projected with force, amplified even further when he puts his hands to his mouth. A sound you feel more than hear. Other deer species like elk bugle with melody, he says, but moose don't sing. Chris has spent hundreds of hours around the species. For moose watching, there are few better places. Experts estimate there are some 76,000 hiding in Maine, the biggest population in the U.S. outside Alaska, and more are found in the western and northern parts of the state than the coastal south. All this makes the Great North Woods a prime spot to find this local icon, the world's largest, heaviest deer species, and a majestic sight to behold. The animal can weigh up to 1,400 pounds and carries an antler rack the width of a small pickup truck. At full pelt, it's as fast as a greyhound. A moose cow can easily take a bear out, says Chris. While there are few black bears here, there are also wolves and lynx, as well as white-tailed deer, otters, mink, and more. For centuries, the local economy has revolved around logging, hunting, and fishing, but the rise of ecotourism is increasingly attracting travelers wanting to come face-to-face with wildlife on safaris. Our tour started from Chris's base camp in the paper mill town of Greenville, 3 hours north of the state's biggest city, Portland. It's located on the shore of the aptly named Moosehead Lake, Maine's largest, where moose outnumber people 3-1. They first appear at no great distance from us, almost hovering over the water, slipping into the scene beneath drooping oaks and firs, hung heavy with lichen. It's a mother with year-old twins, common currency at this time of year, during the autumn breeding season. The calves have no antlers, but dewlaps that dangle from their necks like oversized hip-hop pendants. "Watch the moose's facial expression," whispers Chris. "If it pulls its ears back, it's nervous." In our stillness, at a safe distance, we have no reason to make them frightened. Gradually, they relax to feast, humped necks easing and ears tuning into the woodland soundtrack. The water burbles with the scent of dewy earth in the air. A bald eagle swishes above. An hour passes in near silence, but like Chris has taught me, there's more to it than first meets the ear. I pick out a multitude of details. Muzzle snuffles, contented chews, resonant murmurs. By 8 o'clock, in the dying light, it's all over. The moose family seems to give a farewell nod before trotting off, wading across the golden pond. We're left in the communion with the trees, thinking about this extraordinary spirit of the forest, a creature gigantic, yet one so quiet and well attuned to its environment, it can vanish as if almost having never been there at all. While we're talking about the moose, here's another story. Outdoor Nevada, see the state's newest wild animal. From Nevada Public Radio by Paul Boger. Jarbidge Wilderness. When you think about Nevada wildlife, you probably think about bighorn sheep, wild horses, devil's hole, pupfish, or elk. But on this episode of Outdoor Nevada, host Connor Fields wanders into the Jarbidge Wilderness in search of one of the state's newest residents, moose. Normally at home in the deep woods and wetlands of Canada and states such as Alaska and Minnesota, or Maine, I might mention, moose populations have grown in recent years and extended their habitat south to include Utah and Nevada. According to the Nevada Department of Wildlife, more than 100 moose reside in the extreme northern part of the state. And while the state's moose population is growing, they're still a pretty rare sight. Moose are the largest game species we have in Nevada. They're black, they're big, so you're like, "Oh, I'll see one," said Carrie Hubner, a retired biologist from the Nevada Department of Wildlife. "But I've been humbled so many times." Hubner says she's gone to find moose whose tracking collars indicate they're in, say, an aspen stand or willow patch, only to be disappointed. So you go in and you'll be doggone if you can't pick them out. It can hide pretty well. The Jarbidge Wilderness is an area where moose are making themselves at home. Tucked away in the far northeastern reaches of the state, this area was designated as the Silver State's first wilderness in 1964 and encompasses more than 100,000 acres of thick alpine forests, rugged peaks, sweeping basins, and river-cut gorges. It also boasts amazing hiking, camping, backpacking, fishing, and hunting opportunities. Well, that's all the time we have today for travel stories. I'll end as I usually do with a couple of thoughts for the day. You'll never find an insurer saying, "I don't believe in climate change," and that's from Lloyd's of London CEO John Neal, quoted in the New Yorker. Here's another one. Money is like an iron ring we've put through our noses. We've forgotten that we designed it, and now is leading us around, and that from economist Bernard Later, quoted in the New York Times. This is Ann Dalton reading for Sun Sounds for the program Are We There Yet?
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Information and Audio, then under Program Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sunsounds podcasts on your Echo Dot or other smartphone devices.